This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Coming up later in the show, we'll hear an interview with Matt Bai, author of the new book, All the Truth Is Out, The Week Politics Went Tabloid. But first, let's listen to Terry's recent interview with Lena Dunham, the creator and star of HBO's Girls, a series about a group of friends in their 20s trying to figure out what they want out of life and out of each other. Girls begins its fourth season in January. But Dunham's new collection of personal essays, called Not That Kind of Girl, A Young Woman Tells You What She's Learned, is available now. A note to parents, much of this interview is an adult conversation that deals with sexuality.
Lena Dunham, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you back on our show.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
I want to start with a reading from your new book. So let's start with a reading from the very, very beginning.
Great. This is a reading from the chapter entitled Introduction. I am 20 years old, and I hate myself. My hair, my face, the curve of my stomach. The way my voice comes out wavering and my poems come out maudlin. The way my parents talk to me in a slightly higher register than they talk to my sister, as if I'm a government worker that snapped and, if pushed hard enough, might blow up the hostages I've got tied up in my basement. I cover up this hatred with a kind of aggressive self-acceptance. I dye my hair a fluorescent shade of yellow, cutting it into a mullet more inspired by photos of 1980s teen mothers than by any current beauty trend. I dress in neon spandex that hugs in all the wrong places. My mother and I have a massive fight when I choose to wear a banana-printed belly shirt and pink leggings to the Vatican, and religious tourists gawk and turn away. I'm living in a dormitory that was, not too long ago, an old-age home for low-income townspeople, and I don't like thinking about where they might be now. My roommate has moved to New York to explore farm-to-fork cooking and lesbianism, so I'm alone, in a ground-floor one-bedroom, a fact I relish until one night a female rugby player rips my screen door off the hinges and barges into the dorm to attack her philandering girlfriend. I've bought a VHS player and a pair of knitting needles and spend most nights on the sofa making half a scarf for a boy I like who had a manic break and dropped out. I've made two short films, both of which my father deemed interesting but beside the point, and I'm so paralyzed as a writer that I've started translating poems from languages I don't speak, some kind of surrealist exercise meant to inspire me but also prevent me from thinking the perverse, looping thoughts that come unbidden. I am hideous. I'm going to be living in a mental hospital by the time I'm 29. I will never amount to anything.
Thank you for reading that. That's Lena Dunham reading the reading the opening of her new book, Not That Kind of Girl. One of the opening quotes in your book is from your father. And you say, this is your father admonishing you. And he says, how quickly you transform the energy life throws at you into the folded bows of art. Your father and your mother are artists. What exactly was he criticizing about you there?
I believe that we had had an argument, which I had very quickly recycled into something that I was using in the show, and I told him about it, and he kind of laughed. There's this very specific laugh that my father has when he recognizes his own behavior in my work, this sort of, oh, what now kind of laugh that was that I had just summoned from him. And then he was sort of describing, half admiringly, half with horror, the way that he didn't feel like he could do anything without it being recycled into my work. And it kind of felt like, even though he didn't mean it as a compliment, it kind of felt like the perfect encapsulation of my, of sort of how the day-to-day translates into what I do, at least at this point in my creative life.
Do you think he was partly saying you deflect life and turn it into art, like instead of experiencing it or instead of absorbing what I just told you, you just turn it into art?
Completely. I think that my parents have always gotten frustrated, as have certain other people in my life, you know, namely my current boyfriend, because no other boyfriend paid enough attention to me to care. But they have this feeling as if I'm able to sort of feign a certain kind of self-awareness by putting it into my work, but that by putting it into my work, I avoid actually having the experience. So it's this kind of vicious cycle, but it's rough because it's the only way that I know how to process feelings and move on.
Some people think that you overshare. And I'm wondering, because you do share so much, like in your memoir, and there's so much personal stuff in Girls, whether
whether it really happened to you or not, whether it's autobiographical or not, a lot of people just assume that it is. So have you ever made anything public that was very personal through your work or through your interviews that you later regretted saying?
You know, I've thought about this a lot because it's a challenging thing when you're a person who has a desire or, let's say, a compulsion to share facts about your personal life. If that's the way you process the world, is to make creative content based on your personal life, then you have to be really careful about making yourself feel too exposed. But for me, the biggest concern is my family and the people that I love. And I feel very, very conscious of making sure that my parents, my boyfriend, my friends don't feel in any way demeaned, exposed, or abused by the work that I make. Especially now, there's no writing about someone anonymously. People will pick it apart. They will figure out who that person is. There's sort of no sort of protective measures you can put in place at this point in history to take care of the people you love. So you have to be careful. And so there have been a couple times where I've said things about my parents or about my boyfriend that I felt have been taken out of context or misunderstood that have opened them up to criticism. And that is the stuff that pains me. The term oversharing is so complicated because I do think it's really gendered. I think that when men sort of share their experiences, it's bravery. And when women share their experiences, it's some sort of, you know, it's like people are like, TMI, too much information has always been my least favorite phrase, because what exactly constitutes too much information? It seems like it has a lot to do with who is giving you the information. And I feel as though there's some sense that society trivializes female experiences. And so when you share them, they aren't given considered as vital as their male counterparts. And that's something that I've always roundly rejected.
You know, it's interesting. I think writing about yourself and kind of shaping your personal narrative gives you a certain power over your life because you're controlling the story. But nowadays, you do that, you control your story, you put it out, and the story is not finished yet because everybody's going to tweet about it. They're going to give it their interpretation. So that sense of, like, controlling your own narrative, in a way, it doesn't exist anymore.
That is so accurate. And there are a few things in this book that I was terrified but to put into the world because I thought of the headline and sort of people hearing third hand what existed in the essay. And it was just, it was a really scary thing. And I really had to examine with a few of these essays, is this something that I can bear to see sort of put through that game of telephone?
Can you give us an example of one of the things you were concerned about?
Yeah, I think the chapter about date rape in the book was a really, really terrifying thing for me to put into the world because as important as the topic is, and we are also having this massive moment of cultural awareness about campus assault, which is a very gratifying thing to see, and I hope it leads to incredible change. But just sort of honestly, the idea of seeing sort of, you know, the fourth hand UK Daily Mail headline, Lena Dunham tells all about rape, was it was a nightmare to me. But at the same time, I think I knew that sharing that experience was, I not only felt it was important because of what I was seeing other young women go through, I felt it was important because of what it was going to give me spiritually to not be hiding that anymore.
I thought that was a really interesting chapter, and your confusion about, is this rape or not? Like, am I complicit in this or not? Like, what has happened here? And you were hurt. I mean, I don't mean emotionally hurt, though you were that too. You were physically hurt for a while.
It was a painful experience physically and emotionally, and one I spent a long time trying to reconcile. And I've been thinking about it a lot this week because I sent an email to somebody who I had known at that time who knew the guy who had, perpetrated the act, who knew him, and I wanted to make it clear to this old friend what I felt had happened before he, you know, potentially, you know, bought the book at Hudson News and read about it. I hated the idea of somebody finding out that information because at the time that it happened, it wasn't something that I was able to be honest about. I was able to share pieces, but I sort of used the lens of humor, which has always been my default mode, to try to talk around it. And I said to this old friend in an email, I said, I spent so much time scared. I spent so much time ashamed. I don't feel that way anymore. And it's not because of my job. It's not because of my boyfriend. It's not because of feminism, though all those things helped. It's because I told the story. And I still feel like myself, and I feel less alone.
You write a lot about sex in your memoir and in Girls. A lot of the storylines, revolve around sexuality. So it's interesting to read in your book that it really took you a while to actually enjoy sex.
Yeah. It was interesting. I think I spent so much time being interested in the intellectual content of sex that I forgot to worry about whether it felt good or not.
When you say the intellectual content, you mean
I think I was
the sexual politics of it, or
I mean, I wish it had been as evolved as sexual politics. It was more just that I was so fascinated by the fact that sex allowed me to be in a position where I saw people behaving in these ways that they never would, sort of, you know, standing out on the quad or sitting in a diner. I couldn't believe, you know, I've always been the nosiest person in the world. I mean, my mom always tells a story of, like, you know, from the back seat of the car, she and my dad, when I was like 3, would be talking about someone from work, and I'd scream, "What color's her hair? How old is she? Does she have a husband?" Like, I needed to know everything about everyone. And so somehow when sex began, I went, oh my God, I can't believe that you get to be in a room with somebody behaving this way.
So it sounds like it was the writer in you that was having sex.
100%. And I remember thinking, almost feeling, and I talk about this in the book, like I was, you know, a private detective standing in the doorway watching two people have sex. And I described that experience later to my friend Jemima. And I was like, you know that feeling when you're having sex, but you're kind of outside your own body and you're not really in it and you're watching from the door? And she was like, no. That's the reason I've never needed to make a sex tape, is just because I'm making one in my own mind all the time.
And that's hysterical. So is that one of the reasons why sex is so central to your work? Because you've always been like the observer of it?
I think so. I mean, I think probably if I had been at all points more physically engaged, I might not remember enough to write all of these chapters. But I think, and it's interesting, you know, the thing that's always hard for me to act on Girls, it's very easy for me to do the sort of humiliating sex scenes. But a moment where I'm actually supposed to be enjoying sex and engaged, I find almost impossible to bear performing that because it feels so private.
Right. So was this a disappointment to you at first? Were you expecting much more than what the experience initially was?
Yes, which I think I later realized a lot of women, a lot of young people felt that way, like a real "is this it" quality to sex, because I think we'd been taught by movies, by, you know, romance novels we'd stolen from our babysitters, whatever, and our grandmas, whatever, we'd been taught that it was going to be some kind of totally, you know, you were going to be transported to, you know, the Hawaii of the mind when you had sex, and ultimately that is not what happened. And so I think also realizing how much sort of self-consciousness and self-hatred made their way into the act of sex, especially, you know, sex in college dorm rooms, that was an unfortunate reality to face. But I also found something so poetic about the way that people were revealed to each other and partially revealed to each other through this act. And so, you know, on Girls, I always tell people that I hope that the sex scenes, I mean, they're not just in there for, like, the audience to have a titillating break to see, you know, the side of somebody's breast. They're in there because I think it's sometimes when we get the most information about our characters. And so they're always pushing the plot forward, if not in a concrete way, in sort of a more spiritual way.
The message you get about Hannah in those scenes is almost one of compliance. Like, oh, sure, you want me to do that? I'll do that.
Well, I think a phenomenon that Hannah experienced, and Hannah experienced it because I experienced it, was the sense that if you were a girl who didn't have an ideal body, what you had to offer was your willingness to please, your openness to adventure, and your just, you know, your desire to do it all. And I think there's a very funny joke. I don't know if you know the comedian Monique. But she has an amazing joke in this DVD, Queens of Comedy, where she talks about having sex as a fat girl. And she kind of goes, she says, "You want to put it in my ear? Put it in my ear. Whatever you want. I'll do it. I'm a fat girl. Just do it. I'm down for anything. I'm not like those skinny girls. I can't say no." And I remember thinking Monique had distilled something so perfect with "you want to put it in my ear, just put it in my ear," about the attitude that girls, you don't have to obviously be chubby to feel this. You just have to feel an essential sense that you yourself are not enough.
Does it kind of make you sad when you see very young girls having sex because you know that they might be facing kind of disappointment or emotional hurt?
I think about girls having sex in high school, and obviously there's, you know, there are young couples who are in love, but I just know that, like, I was so emotionally, even if you're physically ready to have sex in high school, I was so emotionally not there. I mean, I would have been playing with Barbies if I thought it was socially acceptable. So I do feel sort of a twinge when I think about girls feeling, you know, a pressure to engage that way as young people, because I think that it's so often our bodies appear ready for things that our hearts and minds are not ready for. And I do also think that, you know, the experience of having sex in college is this sort of, it's this sort of sad, sad hunt for validation. And obviously that is, again, not everyone's experience. There are girls who know what they need physically and emotionally and are getting it. And I applaud them, but that wasn't me. And that wasn't very many of my friends.
So this is way too personal. This is like really getting to oversharing territory, but I'll ask and you could decide how much of this to overshare.
Yeah.
Like the character of Hannah and also her boyfriend in it talk a lot during sex and tell each other things to do. I'll skip this. This is really like way too personal. Moving on.
Oh, I was like, I'm ready for where you're going, Terry.
Okay.
I'm ready to take that journey with you.
All right. Okay. So let me ask it. Are you into like being really talkative?
Well, you know,
not really. Narrating.
I kind of just like, I mean, no, I think there were times in my life where anything anyone suggested to me, I was open to. And that's not a secret because that's what sort of the show is about a young woman who thinks that she will make herself more appealing to the people around her by being completely flexible. Everything from, oh yeah, I'll go to that party that's in deepest Bushwick to, oh yeah, I'll pretend I'm an 11-year-old prostitute. But then it builds all this rage in her. And so, which she expresses at the wrong times and in the wrong ways. And so I think that quality of sort of extreme adaptability if you notice in all their dirty talk, Adam is talking and Hannah's kind of going, okay, all right, whatever you say. She doesn't know how to do it, but she knows how to agree. And I think that that's sort of a cornerstone of this character. But what it's creating in her is this deep, deep resentment about not being heard and not being seen. And so I think the answer is no. In my own sex life, I find that whole idea of sort of, you know, someone like creating an entire narrative where you're like, you know, a teenage slave, totally unappealing and kind of distressing. But I've definitely encountered as a younger woman people who want to engage that way and didn't feel like I was in a position to go, actually, like, I'd rather just, you know, talk about books than do it than talk about books some more.
You write in your book about how you have a lot of phobias, including germophobia, and an obsession with death. Which are the phobias that really plague you the most?
My germophobia has passed. It's expired.
How did that
happen?
How'd it go away?
You know, I think a lot of people with OCD find that because obviously the things they're anxious about aren't truly the things they're anxious about, it's a traveling anxiety that finds its comfortable place to rest. And then it's like a virus that's, you know, or that's moving from person to person and living out its life in different forms. Like that's sort of what,
or like a cold that travels from your nose to your chest to your throat.
Exactly whatever sickness metaphor we want to use, it basically it moves around. And my anxiety has always floated. It always has a focus and then it always goes on its way, and there's a moment of relief after I've resolved one area of anxiety, and then it hops to another, you know, lily pad and sits there for a while. And so as a kid, germophobia was a really, really easy place to go. And then it kind of, you know, it departed and went to other things. And obsession with death is the really hard one because no one can talk you out of that. Everybody can say to you, you know, you're not going to get cancer or you're not going to get Ebola, but you don't have cancer, you're not going to get Ebola, but nobody can say to you, you're not going to die. So that's an easy place for it to go back to again and again and again. At this point, I would say my anxiety often tends to rest on something that's happening career-wise, you know, a phone call I have to make, an email I haven't gotten back, you know, a person I'm worried I've offended, but probably feeling a level of distress about those prospects that is outsized.
I think it was in season three that your character on Girls, Hannah, has a kind of comeback of OCD. And season two? Season three?
End of season two.
End of season two. Okay, yeah.
End of season two, but then it kind of pokes around in season three. So it's sort of, its arc exists through both those seasons.
And how come you didn't address that at the beginning, but waited till, like, season two to get to the OCD? Because I was surprised that, like, suddenly she's OCD.
I know. Some people had that reaction. Some people were like, what? You're shoehorning a mental illness onto this character who's already weird enough? But the fact was that I had had an obsessive compulsive sort of, I mean, well, let's use the term meltdown, right before season one came out and right as we were beginning to shoot season two. I had a moment where those things came back in a way that was really harsh and uncomfortable and a reminder of how bad it could get. And that was something that, you know, because at that point I had a whole writing staff who I worked with and a close relationship with Jenny and Judd, who produced the show with me, that was something that they had lived through with me, and we thought this is exciting and important to talk about. So it was sort of based on the fact that, I mean, in the show, Hannah has to write her book, and she has writer's block, a deadline coming up, a certain kind of attention she hasn't had before, and OCD, which can very often be instigated by stress, comes barreling back. And so that really just paralleled my experience with making the show and finding myself under a new kind of pressure and resorting to these old habits.
Girls is soon coming back for its fourth season. It strikes me...
Yeah, we'll be back in January.
Yeah, so that's actually pretty soon. Have you, Lena Dunham, and your character of Hannah gotten further apart as the show has gotten deeper into the story? Because your life has really changed in a way that Hannah's hasn't. Hannah's kind of like emotionally stuck in a lot of ways, but your life sounds like you've really, you know, been transformed in a lot of ways by the experience of doing Girls.
Well, it's amazing you say that, because I think so many people ask the question, is it hard for you to write about Hannah because now you work in Hollywood and go to fancy parties and your life doesn't resemble hers? And I think to myself, no, that's not hard because, firstly, I don't go to that many fancy parties. But secondly, we all understand what it's like to feel, you know, we all can transfer the awkwardness we feel at any social event to any other social event. And you're a writer, so you use your imagination and you create circumstances that don't necessarily exist. But it is hard sometimes to continue to write a character who has such sort of limited and limiting responses to the world around her. And I really have to remember where she's coming from and have sympathy for her and recognize that, well, just in the kind of scope of television, I mean, I don't know, our one of our writers, Max Brockman, is the keeper of the timetable of the show. He could tell you exactly how many weeks, months, years have passed since in the world of the show from the first episode to the 42nd episode. I do not have that brain. But I will say that the span of time we've covered in the show is much shorter than the span of time in which I've been doing the show. So she's grown less both chronologically and emotionally than I have since we started.
Mm-hmm.
She's only had one birthday since we began.
Oh, wow. Okay. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Lena Dunham, the creator and star of the HBO series Girls, and now the author of the new memoir, Not That Kind of Girl. I want to play a scene from season three of Girls, which was shown earlier this year. And Hannah had a deal with a publishing company called Mill Street to write an e-book memoir. And she was working with an editor there who was played by John Cameron Mitchell, who really loved, like, transgressive writing.
He wanted her to be like a real, empowered, like the new Tamma Janowitz, just like out on the streets, doing drugs, living life. And she was like, she's kind of a nerd. Like, yeah.
So anyways, that editor died. And in this scene, Hannah's at his funeral. And Hannah and a lot of other people assumed that this editor was gay, but she's just met the editor's wife. The editor's now widow. And so here's Hannah trying to talk with the editor's wife, now widow, who's played by Jennifer Westfeld, And
who's the best? Yeah.
And so this is like maybe the second time that they've spoken.
Hi again.
Oh, hi.
Hannah.
Right.
Not Paige. Hannah.
I know. I'm sorry.
No, don't be. I was surprised that David has such a beautiful, just stunningly.
You thought he was gay.
No.
Yes, you did.
No.
Yes, you did.
I didn't.
It's okay.
I didn't think
it's
he
okay.
was. I
it's
didn't.
Right.
I thought he was straight.
It's okay.
I thought he was straight. I thought he wanted
no,
to sleep with me.
Really?
I didn't. I mean, I didn't think. Wouldn't
Everybody,
have slept with
a
him,
lot
but
of people
I.
think it. A lot of people think he was gay.
Well, he acted gay, so.
And you know, he was. Sometimes.
Okay. I loved your working with your husband. David was wonderful.
Oh, I bet. I mean, I know. I'm working on a book with David, too. I was.
I really hope you finish the book, and I really, really hope I get to read it someday.
Thank you. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, now that Mill Street has dropped all of David's projects, I'd have to find a new publisher, so, you know, we'll
Wait,
see.
You said Mill Street's dropped all of David's projects.
Yeah. Oh, there's David's mom. She's so devastated. Have you seen Pepper? Did
no,
you meet her?
I didn't.
She's
no.
devastated.
Wait, you were just
and
saying
I
that
them.
You were saying that Mill Street's dropped all of David's projects.
Right. That's right. For now, yeah.
So it's... my book is dead. Do you happen to know another publisher that I could maybe slip the manuscript to if I do decide that I really want to try to... keep it alive, or...
Okay, if I do give you another name, will you get the out of here?
Yes.
Great. Great, I'll be back. Honestly. Yes.
I loved your husband.
Just a reminder, that's a scene at a funeral.
She's such a jerk.
Your character of Hannah, everything she said is so completely inappropriate.
She's such a jerk. I think she put some kind of premium on, like, honesty, like the idea that she's going to be the person who really cuts through it and is really real about what's actually going on. But she forgets that, like, certain social constructs are in place for a reason. Like, that's the reason that you don't ask people for professional contacts at funerals.
So... You just called her such a jerk. How do you feel about writing and playing a character who you just described as such a jerk?
It's so fun. I honestly, it's really, really fun. I mean, it's such a pleasure to play somebody who sort of lacks the filter that we all walk through the world with. And of course, like, of course I wouldn't recommend her as, like, you know, a model of behavior to any young people in the world today. But I love the opportunity to just, like, say the word. I mean, it's funny. Tourette's and OCD are very closely linked together. A lot of people who have one have the other. And I remember, you know, I don't have Tourette's syndrome, but I definitely have the part of myself that was always afraid. One of my fears as a kid was that I was going to walk down the street and, like, just, you know, scream out a curse word or, you know, yell a homophobic slur or just do something that was totally, you know, not... my personal, I was going to say the worst thing that I didn't want to say, but it was just going to come out of me. And it's almost like that Tourette's-y, horrific part of me gets to be expressed in Hannah, who's just firing off, and she just can't stop. I mean, she just can't stop.
Lena Dunham speaking with Terry Gross. You'll find a longer version of their conversation online at freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Matt Bai, author of the new book, All the Truth is Out, The Week Politics Went Tabloid. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Decades ago, American presidents could carry on extramarital affairs, secure in the knowledge that journalists of their day regarded such things as off-limits in their reporting. Today, politicians understand that their private lives are fair game in media coverage, and that a revelation on an obscure website can do quick and serious damage to their careers. According to our guest, political writer Matt Bai, a critical juncture in the transformation of political coverage was the 1987 scandal that destroyed the career of Colorado Senator Gary Hart. Hart was by far the leading contender for the 1988 Democratic presidential nomination, when in the course of a week, revelations of his relationship with a young woman named Donna Rice touched off a media frenzy that torpedoed his campaign. In Matt Bai's new book, All the Truth is Out, he re-examines the Hart scandal, reconstructing the events with fresh interviews of the participants, and raising questions about what's become of political journalism in America. Matt Bai spent many years as a political correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. He's now the national political columnist for Yahoo News. Bai spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies earlier this week.
Well, Matt Bai, welcome to Fresh Air. So you spent a lot of time reviewing the events of 1987 in advance of the 88 presidential campaign. Talk to all of the players that would talk to you nowadays. So let's go over some of this. Historically, before 1987, what were the standards employed by journalists in covering politicians' private lives?
Well, it's too facile to say private lives were never an issue in politics or in presidential politics. You certainly can't say the character wasn't an issue. We always cared about these things. What we didn't have were journalists going out and sort of playing detective or private investigator and trying to bring into the public arena what were considered private behaviors that were generally off limits. So that, you know, in the case of, say, a Franklin Roosevelt, a John Kennedy, a Lyndon Johnson, all of whom we now know were not angels in their private lives by the standards most of us have for our marriages, but none of that was considered news. Even later, after it was understood that John Kennedy had not only had extramarital affairs, but associations in terms of the mafia and a mafia mistress that, you know, were really, I would consider quite reckless. Most of that was treated as something separate from his presidency. He still gets very high marks as a president.
And in addition to the media not going out and, you know, staking out people's apartments, there were things that they knew that they just left out of coverage. You have a remarkable story of Lyndon Johnson telling some reporters, I forget, maybe it's as he's beginning the campaign, that, you know, you're going to see some ladies I bring into these hotel rooms.
That's right.
And everybody understood that's not part of our coverage.
Right. He says, I want the same courtesy that you gave President Kennedy. I think he calls him Jack, actually. And he gets the same courtesy.
All right, so tell us a little bit about Gary Hart as the 1988 presidential campaign approaches. Who was he? What was his place in American politics?
I mean, Hart was an extremely compelling figure in the mid-1980s. He was really the first of the 60s generation, the activist, reformist generation to reach the pinnacle of national politics. He's George McGovern's campaign manager at 30. He was involved in the post-McGovern reforms of the party. He gets elected to the Senate just 2 years after that campaign in 1974, and he becomes instantly a very compelling figure in the Senate because a lot of people expect him to be this knee-jerk liberal, but he comes and he masters military reform. He gets very interested in how you reform the military to fight new kinds of conflicts. He's the first national candidate to really talk a lot about what comes after the industrial economy, transforming to an information-based economy, what comes after the Cold War. He talks about the Cold War ending imminently and what will come next. He talks about the rise of stateless extremism in much of the world that we're dealing with now. By 1984, he runs for president in 84. No one gives him any chance. He comes out of nowhere to win New Hampshire. It becomes a two-man race with he and Walter Mondale, the former vice president, and Hart goes on to win every state west of the Mississippi and come about as close as you can come and not get the nomination. Were it not for the superdelegate system, I think he would have had it. So by 1987, he is the presumed nominee of the Democratic Party, and in fact, there are, he's polling double digits ahead of the next two people, and the next two people, who were Mario Cuomo and Lee Iacocca, were not even running for president and did not run.
So we have this guy running for president with great prospects, and views private life as private, doesn't want to talk about his personal life or his feelings. And historically, journalists had left a lot of people's private lives out of bounds in their coverage. But you note that journalism itself had begun to change, and the examination of, you know, private conduct and character was more a part of their focus. Why?
Well, there's just a bunch of forces coming together by the mid-1980s. But, you know, it really goes back to Watergate. So the nation is still reeling, in a sense, from the effects of Watergate, which really injects this new focus on personal morality. into our politics, right? How could a guy so petty, so dishonest, have risen to this level, and how do we prevent it from happening again, right? And then there's changing social attitudes in both parties, really, both sides of the ideological spectrum about private behavior and adultery in particular. Because you have now the women's liberation movement has happened. There's this debate over the Equal Rights Amendment. Suddenly, you know, the sort of Mad Men era tryst over lunch, which everybody used to wink and nod at, isn't so funny anymore. And then you have some profound changes in the nation's media. Post-Watergate, there is a real just idolatry for Woodward and Bernstein. And all the younger reporters coming in really see it as their great calling to find a scandal, to expose someone, to have that kind of fame and that kind of notoriety. And that's a very different factor. And you have technological change in the media. So satellite dishes are brand new. 1988 will be the first campaign where everybody has them. That means you can broadcast from anywhere at any time. And that creates a lot more of a pull towards soap opera entertainment type coverage of politics, because now you can go live all day long. You're spending a lot of money to keep a satellite someplace. You want to be able to report every little turn in a story, and you want to keep people in their seats. So you have these new kinds of scandals, like that year, if your listeners remember the Jim and Tammy Faye Baker story of the preacher accused of rape and the wife who's standing by him and crying with the mascara running down her face on Nightline. It was Ted Koppel's most watched interview to that point. You know, stories that wouldn't necessarily, by traditional standards, have that much significance, but that suddenly have become a kind of hybrid of tabloid and serious news. And all of that is churning in the culture at exactly the moment when Hart really takes the leadership of the Democratic Party and begins steaming toward the nomination.
So as the 1988 presidential campaign approaches, we have this remarkable candidate who doesn't quite get that the media focus on character is changing. Let's talk about the scandal itself. The events that would overtake Hart's campaign began with a sailing trip, which was unknown to anybody for many weeks. Tell us about that.
Yes, he goes to Turnberry Isle near Miami and on a chartered yacht there, famously known as Monkey Business. He meets Donna Rice, who he's actually met before, but he doesn't remember. She's a model and an aspiring actress, also a pharmaceutical saleswoman. And he and his pal, who's with him, invite her and her friend to come on a sort of cruise to Bimini. The story that Hart has always told is that it was not supposed to be an overnight trip. They were just supposed to go to Bimini and come back, but customs closed and they got stuck there. There's a whole argument about this. But in any event, they take the cruise, they come back. He stays in touch with her, and all of this happening sort of concurrent with the announcement of his long-awaited announcement of his presidential campaign.
And up to this point, had suspicions or rumors of Gary Hart's, you know, relationships with women been in the media at all?
Well, they're starting to bleed into the media. Newsweek magazine does a piece in which they reference a kind of zipper problem. They kind of use a quote from a former aide to Hart. And that opens the floodgates for everybody to start asking. And soon the announcement itself is overtaken by all of these questions. Senator, are you going to answer questions about your personal life? All of this takes Hart quite aback. He's not expecting it. And he basically maintains the line that, you know, my life is boring. You'll have to trust me on it. But look, this isn't anybody's business. It's not what the voters care about. And these allegations are all very nonspecific, and I'm not going to talk about them. It's nobody's business.
So the discussion of his, quote, womanizing is sort of around the fringes of coverage. And there's this reporter, Tom Fiedler of the Miami Herald, who writes something about this and then gets a call. Tell us that part of it.
He writes a piece in the Herald, the Miami Herald, basically saying, you know, look, if you got something on Hart, go ahead and write it if it pertains to his integrity. Tom's not opposed to bringing his personal life into the campaign, but he says, you know, all of this innuendo, all of this vague innuendo about him being a playboy, you know, isn't really fair to him. And he writes this piece in the Miami Herald, and then his phone rings at his desk, and a woman's on the line, and she says, you know, there's rumors you're writing about. Well, I happen to know they're true, and I have evidence. And thus begins the unraveling of Gary Hart.
Yeah, so what does she tell him? What happens?
Well, she tells him that her friend, she doesn't name Donna Rice, she tells him that she has a friend, that she's seen Hart once, that she's going to see him again in Washington, that she has pictures of the two of them together, that the woman can't stop talking about how she can't wait to see this Gary again and how much she likes him. And she tells them when she'll be in Washington. And she even says to Feeler, why don't you go get a seat on the plane next to her? You can follow her. And the Herald ultimately decides to send first Tom McGee, its top investigative reporter, and then Feeler and someone else from Miami and somebody else in the D.C. Bureau. They end up sending about five people to the house and actually stage a stakeout where they position themselves in front of the house, disguise themselves, and ultimately see Hart inside with this woman, see them come and go. They contend that she stays the night because they don't see her leave, although there's some question about a back door and whether it was watched or not watched. And so there they are in rental cars outside Hart's house, trying to catch him in the act, as it were.
So the Miami Herald writes a story the following Sunday, a long story. What does it say?
Well, the Herald does a long story. It's Hart linked to Miami woman, and they describe having seen this woman go into his house and not having left Friday night, and how the two of them then were seen entering and leaving. And then at the end of their story, there it says, you know, this comes after Hart told the New York Times that reporters should put a tail on him and follow him around. And it simultaneously appears in that day's New York Times. It's the first inkling that this idea of a challenge, this follow me around quote, is going to follow Hart around, in fact, for basically the rest of his life.
So after the Miami Herald writes this story, you know, Hart linked to Florida woman, he knows he has a problem, but we're in uncharted territory here. I mean, no one's ever quite faced this. And Hart decides he's going to proceed with his campaign and trust voters to discern that this isn't what matters. And, you know, mm-hmm. It's fascinating when you describe these events because, I mean, I've covered a fair number of presidential candidates' visits now, and they're all carefully crowd-controlled. I mean, if a candidate is going to stroll down like an open-air market, in fact, there will be like a line of security people. The candidate will have a microphone so that presumably spontaneous interactions can be heard, but you can't get close to the candidate. It was different then, and Hart had to try and campaign amidst a maelstrom.
It's a kind of craziness the political world has never seen, because now you have the tabloid photographers in New Hampshire leaping over bushes and cars, and you've got political reporters whose attitude is, you know, they've always been pretty genteel and they have a set of rules, but their attitude is, hey, this is our turf. This is New Hampshire. This is a presidential campaign. We're not ceding the picture and the story to you. And so they're now jumping over bushes and pushing people aside. You know, they were just getting run over and he was getting run over. And there's a story he tells that affected him very deeply of watching. There's a 4 or 5 year old boy nearby, and the crush of cameras goes with him everywhere. He can't move. He can't talk about anything, but having to deflect these scandal questions. And the little boy starts to fall. He's falling to the ground. Hart sees this a few feet away, and he can't move. He's kind of pinned down, and he sees a photographer he knows in front of him, a Newsweek photographer, I think, and he says to him, help me, because he's losing his balance trying to get to this kid. And all he sees in front of him is flash, 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 the pop of the bulbs in his face. And he you know, literally loses his balance and falls. And that's, to him, that was sort of this moment he never forgot, because it was a moment where he turned to the kind of journalist he'd known all along and said, you know, please restore some sanity. And the sanity was gone in that moment.
There was a news conference he had. Was it New Hanover?
In Hanover, New Hampshire. Hanover, yeah, New where Hampshire. Dartmouth is. Yeah,
yeah, and where Paul Taylor, who was then at the Washington Post, asks a long-remembered question. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, and this is the other really fascinating turn in the story. So the Washington Post now, at the behest of Ben Bradley, the hero of Watergate, has evidence of another affair that had been going on some time ago in the recent past. And their plan is to confront Hart with this. But the thing is, Hart still hasn't said he's never been unfaithful to his wife. All he said is that he's going to be a moral person, right? So Paul Taylor, who was a star reporter for The Washington Post, one of the really up-and-coming political reporters in America at that time, he goes to New Hampshire. This is, again, you know, just to paint the scene, this is a crazy scene. It's boiling hot. They have no idea how to set something like this up. There's no crowd control. There's literally an aide on all fours as a human barrier to keep the reporters from overrunning Hart. And Taylor gets up and says, they have an exchange in which Taylor asks him if he's a moral person. He says, yes, I am. He says, do you consider adultery immoral? And Hart says, I guess I do. And Taylor says, "Senator, have you ever committed adultery?" And there's a – anybody who was in that room will tell you – I think anybody I've ever talked to who was in that room will tell you how stunned they were by that question. They remember it. They remember standing there. No presidential candidate had heard it asked publicly like that. And this is on national television. Have you ever cheated on your wife? And it was a really pivotal moment in American politics.
When you spoke to Hart later and for this book, did he recount these moments? Did he tell you what he was thinking in that news conference?
He did. He did. And he says, you know, the first thing that goes through his mind is he's looking at all these reporters who he's known, who covered him in 1984, some of whom had very well-known affairs, some of whom were, you know, having adulterous affairs on the campaign trail that he had been well aware of. And he's thinking, I can't believe the hypocrisy. He's looking at their faces, looking at him, and he's thinking, really? You know, you're going to ask me about this. And then his second thought is, well, what is the biblical definition of adultery, and how do I answer this question? And he ultimately says to Taylor, when he finally goes through this process and opens his mouth, I don't think I should have to answer that question.
So the campaign is essentially paralyzed by this. How long does it take before he, in effect, gives it up, suspends the campaign?
He's gone within 24 hours of that. You know, they go to dinner. He hears that the press has been staking out his daughter at her college lecture hall. But it's become increasingly clear to the staff by that night that he's not going to be able to campaign effectively. And then Taylor shows up at the hotel where the press is staying and tells Hart's press secretary that they have evidence of this other affair, that they're going to run with the story. And Hart's aides, you know, Billy Shore, his closest aide, knocks on his door at the hotel where Hart is staying over the border in Vermont and says to him, you know, this, you got to talk to the press secretary, Kevin Sweeney. And he calls up Sweeney, and Sweeney says, this is what the Post has. This is what they're going to run. And Hart says, this is never going to end, is it? And Sweeney says, you would know that better than I. And Hart says, let's go home. And that's what they do.
Matt Bai is the author of the new book, All the Truth is Out. You'll find a much longer version of his conversation with Fresh Air's Dave Davies online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancula.